You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network.
This is James Altucher at the James Altucher Show. I'm really happy to have one of my favorite podcasters, writers, whatever, Adam Carolla on the show. Adam, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Adam, you've had like an incredible career. Like some people are, you know, they have a TV show or they're a writer or they're a podcaster. I feel like you've done everything, and it's in such a way that people can learn from it. I feel like there's this mythology of, you know, go to college, get the job, work hard, then retire, and life is good. You've sort of, and you even say this in your book, President Me, you're a self-made millionaire, but you've pieced it together from scratch. Like, in the very beginning, you met Jimmy Kimmel by being his boxing trainer. Like, how did that happen?
I had been studying comedy and attempting to do comedy with no real success for a number of years. And I always wanted to get into radio, and I always wanted to learn about radio. And once I found out that there was going to be a boxing match between Jimmy Kimmel and Michael the Maintenance Man, the morning zoo crap. Jimmy was the sports guy. Michael was the maintenance man. Once I learned
classic boxing
that,
match.
Yes, I said I want to be a part of this. And I didn't go there to meet Jimmy. I went there just to see what the radio station looked like and try to learn something. I ended up hooking up with Jimmy, and we became very fast friends. And I think we both realized pretty immediately that we were both would be good for each other. And since no one else seemed to care or appreciate us, we figured we could appreciate us. He wasn't doing anything back then either. And, you know, he got me into radio. And as I say, the rest is history.
And I think people don't appreciate it. It's not like you guys suddenly pitched the Man Show and were huge successes. Like you mentioned in one of your books, I think it was your second book, you guys are like traveling around the country, sharing hotel rooms. Like you really were working every step of the way to climb that ladder in the entertainment industry. It wasn't like this, you know, entitled success.
Yeah. You know, what people don't realize is I don't think people can intellectually understand that Jimmy Kimmel, there was a time when Jimmy Kimmel wasn't Jimmy Kimmel, and nobody knew who he was and nobody cared who he was. You know, there's this, I suppose there's always this sort of feeling like someone is looking at Jimmy when he's 27 and winking and going, oh yeah, one day, I know. It was quite the opposite. You know, people, we proposed doing a radio show together at some point. And actually what happened is somebody proposed I do a radio show. And I pulled that person aside and I said, I got a better idea. How about me and my buddy Jimmy Kimmel do the show together? And this guy, who had 20 years in the radio industry, said, Jimmy's more of a behind-the-scenes guy. He's not really what you call talent.
Why did you want to bring him along? Why didn't you want to do it yourself?
Because I saw something in Jimmy very immediately, and Jimmy saw, you know, first off, I felt a sense of allegiance to the guy for what he'd done for me over a pretty short period of time, number one. Number two, I liked him on a personal level, I wanted to hang with the guy, but I also thought, here's a talented guy. So why wouldn't I want to work with this guy? We're very funny together. What's wrong with that? But nobody else at the time saw it, and I understood. You know, that's the other thing too, is you think everyone's just going to jump in line. They're not. You know, they're not just going to jump in line. Not at all. Not by a long shot. As a matter of fact, you know, when we were pitching the man show around, we had people telling us, well, what about the feminine point of view? And we'd say, well, there is no feminine point of view. And they'd go, well, what kind of show is this? And
we'd say, well, now we have the show Girls. That's the feminine point of view.
Right. We go, it's called the man show. That's the show. And they'd go, well, no, not so fast. You need a feminine point of view in there. And it just goes to show that, look, most people aren't what you call visionaries.
Well, you know, it seems like with podcasting, you were able to do away with the gatekeepers. You don't have to worry about any network executives. And I mean, I've seen in your books, you've pitched shows to CBS, NBC. You've dealt with so much rejection, but you keep, you know, as they say in the entrepreneurship world, you keep pivoting. You keep finding an alternative way to get your message out. And podcasting was perfect for you because there's no gatekeepers.
Right. And that's, you know, then, but look, it's good and it's bad in the sense that it's put up or shut up. That's what the podcast is. You know, people go, you know, hey, it's great. You don't have the man and you don't have the machine and you don't have to deal with this and you don't have to deal with that. Right. But you also don't have to deal with a contract and a steady paycheck. You don't have to deal with anything. You're on your own.
Right, you're on your own, which, like you say, has its pros and cons, but when it works, the pros outweigh the cons. I mean, look at you, Adam. You didn't go to college, or you dropped out early on. You tried every job in the book. I don't even know why you started studying improv comedy. Maybe you could talk about that, but then you worked it and built up.
I was realistic about what I thought my strengths and weaknesses were. And I think it's important to, you know, everyone so busy trying to pat everyone on the back and figure out how unique and special we all are. It's also really super important to figure out what you suck at too. And also, you know, the other thing that always kind of cracked me up about school and business is, you know, they'd go, well, do you want to be a fireman? Do you want to be a lawyer? Do you want to be a doctor? Do you want to be a nurse? Do you want to be a school teacher? They should tell you, I've always said this, you know, it's funny because I was talking to my kids and I got into that, you know, what do you want to do? What do you want to do? And they said, well, you know, I want to be a school teacher, or I want to work at the zoo, you know, whatever kids tell you. And my answer was, okay, you know, you can work at the zoo, but if you want to work at the zoo, you can't drive daddy's car. And they said, you know, what do you mean? And I said, you're not going to be able to afford daddy's car. This car you love driving around in so much? Yeah. I said, you work at the zoo, you can't afford to drive this car, which is fine. Just you should know that when they say nurse, school teacher, doctor, lawyer, there's some pretty big gaps and pretty big differences in compensation for those jobs. And it never gets discussed. It's just, hey, I want to be a fireman. Well, okay, you can be a fireman. You ain't driving an Audi A7.
That's funny. You know, I had a similar conversation with my dad when I told him I wanted to be a psychologist. And he said, you know, you're not going to make any money if you're a psychologist. And I said, that's okay. It's not all about money. And then he was just brutally honest with me. He said, well, you're not going to meet any women that way. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah, and he was just, and he was an ugly guy, and I'm an ugly guy, and he was just right. So I had to figure out a job that made me more money. So I don't know if it helped me meet more women, but we'll see.
Well, your dad was the point is your dad was realistic about your skill and your. I mean,
true.
No, I mean that's look. You're not doing. We can all agree that it is BS, and nobody abides by telling every young African-American boy he's going to end up in the NBA playing with LeBron James. That's irresponsible. The answer is, hey, focus on your education. You're not going to be LeBron James. So, all right, maybe the kid's dream is to play hoops for the Miami Heat, but you know what? That's not going to happen. And you wouldn't be a responsible teacher, parent, anything if you said it was going to happen.
Well, you know, it's funny. There's a lot of people always ask me, how do I find my passion? And the answer is not how do you find your passion. The answer really is how do you start to get good at things? Because you're going to be passionate about what you're good at. You're going to enjoy what you're good at and what you get pleasure from. You'll get pleasure from what you're good at. So how did you find what led you from all these kind of random jobs to improv comedy, which you started to study when you were relatively young?
Well, you know, I didn't like reading very much, and I was pretty good at sort of making stuff up as I went along. So anything that involved a script or scripted or reading or rehearsal was not something that this D-minus student wanted to do. But anything that involved making it up, essentially winging it as you go along, sounded kind of intriguing to me. So this is basically the, you know, comedic manifestation of never studying.
I guess that's true, because with improv, there's always the first rule is say yes. So it's like you come up with the answer, and that's the correct answer in improv. Whatever you say,
right,
that's the correct answer.
Right.
You get this.
Yes,
you get to skip the whole education part, the testing part. There's no test.
Well, ultimately, there'll be a big test, which will be, can you make money in this profession or not? I mean, that'll be the ultimate test.
When did you first realize, and this is long after probably you met Kimmel, when did you first realize, hey, I'm making a living at this, I'm going to make some money at this?
As soon as Kimmel and I started doing what we were doing, or it was even before Kimmel for me, because I was doing Loveline and that kind of thing. But as soon as I started doing what I was doing and doing it fairly well, I realized, and then I started looking around at the competition, and I realized the competition was weak. And that's when I realized I could do it.
Who did you consider your competition?
Everybody who had a sense of humor, and I didn't consider them to be that good. Like, quite honestly, I realized I was funnier than the people I was basically dealing with. I don't mean in some sort of, you know, cage match comedy competition. I just mean
that's not a bad idea, though.
I listened to Kevin and Bean on the radio and K-Rock for years, and I was a fan of theirs, and I still am a fan of theirs. But I realized pretty quickly I was funnier than they were. Now, you know, they have a different skill set, and I love them dearly, but I thought pretty quickly and pretty early on, I remember thinking, oh, I can take these guys. And, you know, in a comedy competition. Now, I'm not as good a broadcaster as they are, and so on and so forth. But I sort of remember just kind of going, oh, I'm better than a lot of these guys. I don't know what the – then it became a sort of – I don't know what the hell I was doing wasting my time.
So you were doing The Man Show, and you mentioned in one of the books – again, I think it's your second book – you were making about $800 a week – doing The Man Show. Were you also doing stand-up or shows around this? Like, you mentioned at this point, you were making money, you started buying stuff.
I don't I don't think I said I was making $800 a week during the Man Show.
Oh, $800 a show. MTV was paying.
Oh, that was probably for Loveline.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't how much money I was making. It was more like I'm making consistent money. I'm working in an air-conditioned studio. I'm getting lunch for free. You know, it was more about that for me, that I just couldn't believe that I would get paid for sitting down and interviewing people and get free lunch out of the deal. Just didn't, I couldn't fathom it.
And so this was this unbelievable thing. Is this the point where you said, okay, this is what I'm going to do, some form of this for the rest of my life? Or did you still have doubts, or what was going through your head?
Not a lot really ever goes through my head. I
don't believe that. I've read your books. A lot of things go through your head, and we're going to get to that in a minute.
Well, not to sound overly humble, but I just mean it's like it's always been sort of onward and upward. It never was about. I was never Jim Carrey sitting up on Mulholland looking over the lakes of Los Angeles and writing myself a check for $10 million that one day I would cash. Like I never got into that bullshit. I was just like, look, you know, you got a good sense of humor. And there are guys with a good sense of humor that manage to make a good bit of money, and then there's guys with a good sense of humor manage to commit suicide, overdose on heroin. So, you know, the good sense of humor part is nice, but also be nice if you could kind of point it in a direction that worked out versus flame out.
And I feel like you kept working it, and you were rejected from things quite a bit. Like, you pitch a CBS show, it gets rejected. You pitch an NBC show, it gets rejected. How did you keep sort of, keep going through, coming up with ideas, trying out new things? Like, what were sort of your incentive to keep trying new ideas out?
Well, that stuff is, you know, the CBS, the NBC, you know, I did a Fox animated pilot that I loved. I thought it was great. People can go to YouTube and type in Birchum, I think it's B-I-R-C-H-U-M, and watch it. I loved it, and it got rejected. It's a constant. It's not like I used to get rejected in the beginning, and now there's this. And that's an ongoing thing. I get rejected for stuff all the time. Three-quarters of stuff I try out doesn't work out to this day. It used to be 7%. Now I've cut it down to 71%, but it's the same thing. It doesn't change.
I think people in general are afraid of that, though. So you people know that when they take their 9-to-5 cubicle job, say, and again, there's nothing wrong with that, but I feel like they stay in their comfort zone because it reduces that percentage of rejection. You have to be willing to break out of that comfort zone to really succeed.
But the whole thing about rejection is it's kind of like, I don't know, cop writing you a chicken ticket for rolling for a four-way stop. Like, how personally do you want to take that? Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
I don't, CBS, NBC, Fox, they pass on 100 shows a year. And then the next year, they pass on another 100. And since I got passed up by CBS and NBC, they passed on 2,000 shows. I'm not sitting around licking my wounds. I know those shows would have been successful. I know the ideas were good. I felt strongly about them. I gave it all I had to give. I never, you know, the only time I feel bad is when I feel like I didn't do a good job. I don't feel that way. I felt like I did a good job, and it didn't work out.
So I want to talk about your most.
I don't look at it as being rejected.
Right. So in your last book, President Me, the America That's in My Head, you describe essentially your vision of America if you were president. It's, I sort of say, and you've sort of said, it's half joke, half real. But what I really see in this book is you're kind of underlining, you know, all the ways in which America has felt entitled or dumbed down, and you come up with corrections and fixes. And I just want to read my favorite line from the book, because I think it's really true. So you say in the book, somewhere in the middle, if I get a hooker, I want her to come with a vagina. And what you're referring to is the one guy on the film set who was a vegetarian, so the whole crew had to eat vegetarian food. And it's right. Sort of like this idea that everything has become, everybody becomes entitled. Everyone wants to kind of get the lowest common denominator of every situation. But you want the real thing. And America has sort of kind of gotten dumbed down as a result.
Yeah, I when you do a film crew, a movie or whatever it is, you have to get a vegetarian. You know, if someone's going to Quiznos on a sandwich run, they get a box of beef sandwiches, they get a box of chicken sandwiches, and they get a box of veggie sandwiches, except for there's 45 people on the crew and there's only two vegetarians, and the two vegetarians ain't into eating. So there's a whole box at the end of the day, there's a whole box of vegetarian sandwiches that nobody wants sitting there. And the sad part about the whole endeavor is the next day when they go on a lunch run, they do the exact same ratio again, which drives me insane.
But this is just an example of, in general, the dumbing down of America, the lack of common sense. And you mentioned, for instance, all the anti-smoking marketing messages and public service announcements and everything we get, when everybody already knows that smoking causes cancer. There's not a single person in America who doesn't already know that. So why is America still spending billions trying to convey this message? Like, throughout the book, you bring up examples where just the dumbing down of America has cost us billions or trillions of dollars.
I believe it's, you know, I don't really think of it as a dumbing down of America. I think of it as a sort of almost disdain that our politicians have for us, which is they're not interested in fixing anything. They're not interested in correcting anything. Their main interest is just saying, look, we're taking a controversial stance against people not smoking. Big deal. Like, that's their thing. They don't really care about you. They don't care about your health. They don't care about your well-being. They really care about getting through life without getting into trouble, saying anything controversial, or even doing anything. You know, I drive through Los Angeles all day, every day. We have these multi-million-dollar freeway signs, these big multi-million-dollar freeway signs. They're electronic. They're computerized. There's hundreds of them. It probably costs millions of dollars a year to keep working and keep active. And all they ever say is click it or ticket on them. Now, so what are they saying? Put your seatbelt on. To who? The hundreds of millions of people that are driving underneath them with their seatbelts on as they speak? What are we talking about here? Every single car that's manufactured has a placard and a chime and a light up thing that goes off when your seatbelt is not on. So what the f*** do we need this for?
Right. So
we don't need
that,
it. Well, what I'm saying is it's a perfect example. Obviously, there's not a human being you know who either, it's one of two groups. Either you wear your seatbelt, which is 99.9% of everyone we know. We all wear our seatbelts. Then there's the 1% that doesn't wear their seatbelt, and guess who's not going to be affected by a sign that says click it or ticket? The rebel biker who says, I ain't wearing a seatbelt when I'm driving the old lady's car. So that's the one that doesn't give a shit about your click it or ticket campaign. So how many people is this affecting? The answer is zero. There's nobody who isn't either wearing their seatbelt or committed to not wearing their seatbelt, who is passing by your stupid sign. But, now, you know,
it's not just the politicians, though, that you point out. Like, for instance, you have one mention, and this is just one among many, no destination or theme weddings. People in general, like, I personally can't stand being invited to a destination wedding. It's, like, the biggest waste of time in the world. And you're right, this should be outlawed. But it's not just politicians, it's the in general entitlement that people feel like, oh, I'm getting married, so people should come to wherever I invite them to and dress however I want them to celebrate my day. Like, you address this general entitlement that people seem to have across America.
Well, I mean, obviously, it starts at the school, it starts with the kids, it starts with
the parents.
Yeah, I mean, it starts with next to nothing, and now, I mean, when you come to something like a wedding, look out. Now, that's a real, I mean, if you're going to make a big deal out of the nothing occasion, imagine what you're going to make out of the things that are actually occasions, like weddings.
I've lost friends not going to their Hawaii wedding. I'm in New York. There's no way I'm going to fly to Hawaii for, like, July 4th to go to their little half-hour celebration.
I agree.
So why did you title this President Me? Like, obviously, there's a little bit inside of you that really does want to make change and, you know, even for fun of it, run for president. You should make a little party and for fun of it, run for president.
Well, I would, but I think my kids would sue me if I did.
You can make a little constitution, a little bill of rights.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, with as many things as I got going, I got to kind of pick and choose my moments. I mean, if, you know, people say, "Oh, sounds fun," or "Wouldn't it be fun?" or "It'd be fun." But it's like, yeah, I don't have enough time, unfortunately, right now for the stuff that would be fun. I got to do the stuff that would be effective.
Well, you know, look, your podcast is both fun and effective. So let's talk about that. You started off right away. You were like the most popular podcast ever, right? Like, you're in the Guinness Book of World Records. You got to 60 million podcast downloads in 2010, and they put you in there. I think, did they close the record on that? Like, did they say no more? We're that's it.
No, anybody who's doing a podcast is more than welcome to, you know, take a stab at the record. I don't think they do that with Fattest Man or Tallest Man, and I don't think they do that with podcasting either. If you'd like to make a run at it, you're perfectly free to make a run at it.
But clearly you enjoy it. You've been doing it. You're one of the first guys to start consistently doing it. What makes your podcast good? I mean, of course, there's you. But I'm not saying there's a magic formula, but what else goes into making a good podcast? I'm asking advice here.
I think if I was to give advice to anybody as it pertained to doing a podcast, I would simply say do a lot of it. Do it every day. Don't make a hobby out of it, you know. A lot of people do it in a very nonchalant kind of way, you know, a very, you know, catch-as-catch-can kind of way. And I would say do it early and do it often. And you know, if it works, great. If it doesn't work, you're hopefully doing it because you love it anyway. So it'll be academic if it doesn't work. In other words.
Right. And so now, recently, of course, there's this situation where some guy, more or less out of the blue, claims to own the patent on podcasting. So he adjusted his earlier patent in 2009 to claim podcasting. And now he's going after you, Mark Maron, and a bunch of others, saying you guys owe him money because you podcast and he owns the patent. And you've been raising money to fight this battle. It's a court case in Texas. But already the patent office has said, basically, this guy probably doesn't own the patent. Like, what's the status of this case right now?
it's costing us a lot of money and legal fees, and it doesn't look like there's much of a case there, but unfortunately, to prove that, we're going to have to spend a whole bunch of money. So it's, you know, it's kind of good in one way that it'll probably be good for other other people that come after us, but it'll be bad in the sense that you know we'll have shelled out a lot of money in the interim.
Right, because clearly he can't win. Like the patent and trademark office has basically implied this is not a patent. And so even if he wins in civil court, he's not going to win ultimately on appeal.
I don't think there's any way this guy can win at all. But again, that doesn't mean he's not going to charge us a gazillion dollars and legal fees to find out that he couldn't win.
And again, this is me being naive, but why pay legal fees? Why not let him win in local court and then just appeal?
I basically said the same question. If the guy doesn't have a case, why are we even fighting it? Well, the point is as it's been explained to me, the thing goes off, September, and we either show up or we don't, and we have to show up and we have to mount a case. Otherwise, we're going to lose, and if we lose, it can be millions of dollars. So, it's one of these things where I'm with you, and I'm like, what the hell, and who are we talking to here? But unfortunately, I have to listen to the lawyers on this one.
I pretend to be a lawyer on Twitter and usually give very good legal advice, but I will take your word for it that your lawyer said differently. But let me ask you this. So I'm going to play the devil's advocate for a second. Let's say somebody invents something, but they don't have the financial resources to use what they invent. So let's say someone invents the smart toilet, like you pee in a toilet and it diagnoses whether you have cancer or not, but they don't have the financial resources to create the smart toilet, and later, I don't know, GE creates the smart toilet. Shouldn't the patent inventor get something in that case? So this is different
I think,
but I'm just trying to understand patent reform as you see it.
Well, you know, look, I believe it's like anything else. Like we go, look, do we want companies taking advantage of their employees and locking them in sweatshops and blah, blah, blah? And you go, no, we don't. So we're for unions. Right. We're for the spirit of a union and all the good things a union can do. But at some point when the teacher molests the student and we can't fire him because of the union, then we realize, well, it's probably gone too far then at that point. I don't think anybody has any fundamental problem with the notion of people keeping their intellectual property and so on and so forth. I think everybody is, you know, down with that, so to speak. And so, you know, the answer isn't, well, we should have, there should be no such thing as a patent. Like, of course there should be things. There should be a patent. And of course there's a place for people protecting their intellectual property and so on and so forth. The question is when do you cross the line? Where does it go too far? You know, I mean, I think that's something we're running into as a nation constantly. Like, should we pay taxes? Yeah, of course we should pay taxes. Is our taxes a good thing? Yeah, they pay for the roads and the schools. Good. Now, are these guys now going nuts and overtaxing everyone and basically forcing them to move out of the state of California? Yes. So, you know, we can all agree on taxes, and we can all agree that we should pay taxes. But when it starts to spin out of control, that's when there's an issue.
And so here's a case where this guy had this patent for distributing audio cassettes, and long after podcasting started, he modified his patent to include podcasting simply because everyone else forgot to do that. and now he's taking advantage of it.
That's it. Right. Now, you know, if you came up with the line, "Where's the beef?" and I started printing up T-shirts and selling them saying, "Where's the beef?" and I didn't cut you in on it, then that's wrong. On the other hand, what this guy's doing is wrong. So there's always going to be, you know, I think that's the problem with everything, is everybody says, well, you don't think these people should be running wild in the streets, you know, and everyone just ripping off everyone else's idea. And it's like, no, I don't. Because believe you me, I have Mangria. That's my product. I invent things, too. And I don't want someone else coming out with their own line of signature cocktail and calling it Mangria. That's my. I've copywritten it. So I understand that you can't, you know, have my podcast and start selling it to people, and, you know, selling commercial time against this. That's mine. So I understand how that goes. This, unfortunately, is not that.
This is sort of a case where he kind of came up with his patent after the fact, which I don't know the exact laws, but it seems wrong, like after people have been podcasting for 10 years, to suddenly redefine your patent to describe podcasting. That's what seems incorrect to me.
Well, it's not incorrect. It's a obvious play for cash, which is what these guys do, which is why we don't like it.
Has anyone paid him?
He's had various suits with various entities and gotten, you know, some gotten paid, some he's won. Yes.
But not podcast, though. No podcaster has paid him.
No pod. Well, we're the only one he's sued so far.
Okay, so but the EFF is helping you. The Electronic Frontier Foundation is helping kind of deal with the Patent and Trademark Office with this, and they've pushed this as well.
Oh yeah, they're behind this too, but they're not behind us per se.
Right. So are you going to go to Texas in September and actually like be testifying in court?
Most likely. Yeah, that's probably what it's probably going to come down to. That. Yeah.
So
I don't want to, but yeah.
Let's take a worst case scenario. Let's say he wins and somehow or other it goes all the way up to the Supreme Court and they say, yeah, this guy, you owe him money. Like, what's going to happen?
I really have not even considered that. It's virtually impossible that this guy win in any real court environment with us. It's virtually impossible because he just does not have a case terms of, you know, damages caused on our behalf. He just literally does not have a case.
Well, so, and I've been involved in other patent cases, and I can tell you when the Patent and Trademark Office says you don't have a patent, then it doesn't matter what happens in civil court, in a local civil court. There's no money that's going to be exchanged.
Right. And I don't, I am not worried at all about the case. What I'm worried about is spending over $1 million to prove there is no case.
Right. So what's the website people can go to? I know people can donate to your case. What's the website people can go to?
They can go to fundanything.com and /patent troll. They want to find out about this.
Okay, that's good to know. So I want to go for one more second back to your book, President Me, because there's another line that really intrigued me in that book. You're talking about the Arab Spring and all the revolutions that were happening and the people dragging, you know, dead bodies through the street. And, you know, a civilized country should basically ask, and you say this, what would Switzerland do? And I thought that was a very interesting line because I don't really know. And I don't know if you know, like, I didn't really know what Switzerland would do because I don't, it took me a while. I don't think Switzerland has a president. Like, I don't know how they run their country. Do you know how they run their country?
No, but I don't think anyone
knows. I've asked around after I read this line in your book. No one actually knows how Switzerland runs their country.
I don't know, but all I know is you never hear the evening news start off with, you know, trouble out of Switzerland, and especially, you know, not every other news. I mean, every other newscast you turn on is trouble in the Middle East, right?
Yeah. So what would Switzerland do? Well, I want to, again, thank you for coming on the podcast, exchanging ideas. I want to recommend your book, President Me, which I really enjoyed. All of your books I've enjoyed, but this one I very much enjoyed. I think my audience will enjoy it. And also, again, I encourage people to go to fundanything.com/patent troll. I think this is an important case, particularly if you enjoy this podcast, because if you lose, Adam, everyone else sort of loses in this industry. So it's an important case. And again, I really appreciate you spending the time and coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate you taking the time as well.
All right. Thanks, Adam. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Next time. Bye-bye.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network at stansberryradio.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.